One in six people in the UK are said to have very poor literacy skills, according to the National Literacy Trust. Why? Not to be able to read and comprehend the written word is fundamentally disabling. It disallows the sufferer from reading everything, from cooking instructions to completing their tax return. It's an offence to any idea of a we society underpinned by fairness and equal chances, especially in a century where knowledge, skills, and the capacity to learn will be ever more important. Looking to challenge and change this is Professor Anna Vignolas. Her research focuses on issues of equity and value in education, particularly the relationship between educational achievement and social mobility, and the role played by education and skills attainment in the economy and society. She was Professor of Education and Fellow of Jesus College at the University of Cambridge, Professor of Economics of Education at the UCL Institute of Education, and Research Fellow at the London School of Economics Centre for Economic Performance. But now, she's the Director of the Leverhulme Trust, one of the UK's most prestigious grant-making organisations. The Trust funds blue sky research in all disciplines apart from medicine. Welcome to the We Society, Professor Vignolas. When we invited you to join this podcast, and you heard this rather kind of idiosyncratic left-field title, The We Society, what was your first thought?
It reminded me of the phrase, we're in it together. And I think that sort of sums up a lot of the challenges that we face, both as a society, but, you know, broadly as humanity and the world, in terms of, I don't know, climate change, the challenge of AI, a whole load of issues that basically we face them collectively. And whether we recognise it or not, we do. And education in particular is an entirely collective and social endeavour. It takes a lot of people to raise a child. And I think sometimes we don't pay enough attention to that collective bit, the we bit, as we become more individualistic.
Because it was Aristotle, 350 BC, who says a man or a woman who cannot live the common life, cannot partake of society, is either a beast or a god. I want no truck with either. And you're kind of speaking to a kind of long tradition in Western philosophy when you kind of invoke the we, an ethic of the social. Is that how you see yourself? How you position your thinking?
I think anybody who works on education for any length of time really starts to think in terms of we. Although as a parent you're concerned about your individual child before you, and we've done a lot to think about the individual needs of children, when you think about the education process, it's slow, it's cumulative, you learn in lots of different domains, you need lots of help and support along the way. And ultimately, investing, if you want to use that term, in our children is a real vote of sort of confidence in the future, that the future will be better precisely because we've given our younger generations a set of skills that will enable them to cope better in the world and cope with a changing world that's almost inevitably going to need people to be more skilled. So, yes, that's exactly the way I think about it. This is definitely a collective effort that we have here.
Let's just go to the heart of this. I really want you to kind of build on what you've just said, because we're going to talk about inequity and we're going to talk about how to design an education training system better. But I think you should lay out at the very outset of this podcast why you consider that to be so foundational.
I was a bit of a late starter coming into academia, so I actually had a real-world job before I became an academic, and that was in recruitment, in human resources. And I started life trying to recruit people into a factory in South Shields, and it was relatively high-tech. And my job was to administer psychometric tests and try and get the right people to work on the factory floor. It was heartbreaking watching generally men being turned away who lacked the skill. They'd been made redundant from heavy industry. The world had changed. There were limited opportunities for them to retrain. And, you know, there was nothing I could do really to
bring them in. What part of the country was this?
Northeast, South Shields.
South Shields.
Yeah. There was nothing I could do to bring them in because they really couldn't get past basic literacy and numeracy tests. And I think that was probably the first realisation in my life anyway of the huge disparities that we have in terms of education achievement in this country. And that matters not just because, obviously, as I proved, it's difficult to get a job when you don't have the basic literacy and basic numeracy, but also if you think of all the other things that are closed down to people who struggle, particularly with literacy. And really, that shouldn't happen, right? We spend a lot of money on our education system. We would like our children to come out happy, healthy, and literate, numerate. And for me, it's always been a really important question as to why that doesn't happen for all children. Obviously, some do incredibly well out of the system, some not so well, and we need to understand that. And I've spent my life trying to figure that out.
Put like that, I don't think anyone could disagree with you. And I think that there is a sense, isn't there, in Britain that people like you and others can talk about the lost Einsteins and the lost Marie Curies that aren't coming forward because their education system kind of neglects the disadvantaged to such a degree. And these parts of the economy, like South Shields, actually, reeling after the kind of deindustrialization of the 1980s. And the idea was like a kind of capsized ship. It would right itself by market forces. But actually, if the people drowning in the capsized ship can't even read and write and don't have essential literacy skills, there's no capacity to do any self-writing. And here they are 30 years later, still profoundly scarred. And they, you know, they vote the way they vote. They are disillusioned. They're prey for populist politicians. They voted for Brexit. Everybody has a kind of vested interest in this not being the case. And yet it's not held or owned by the political class to the degree that it should be, in my view.
Absolutely. And I think there's a sort of, I mean, we need to understand that better, right? And some of the data that we get on education surprises people. So one of the things, you know, if you look at international test scores of adults, so I'm talking working age population, in almost every OECD country.
OECD is this industrialized proxy for industrialized world, really.
Yeah, but it includes a wide range of countries.
Yeah. Mexico, for example.
Yeah,
Chile,
many of which are poorer than the UK. So compared to most of those countries, in most of those countries, the skill levels of the youngsters are higher than the skill level of older people. And you can imagine why. We've seen a big increase in the number of people staying longer in education, big increase in qualification level, and naturally the younger are coming through more skilled. You don't see that in England, for example. And that, to me, is something that really needs us to stop and reflect. Why is it the case that despite having higher levels of qualification on average, in England, younger people are not more skilled? And there are two reasons. One, we have a group of people who are very low skilled. So we have, you know, the one in six with very low levels of literacy, never getting even to GCSE level. And that's bringing down the average. And that's part of the problem. But the other thing we have is when you compare how our kids do at 15, they're above OECD average, right? And then you look at them in adulthood and they're behind. Why does that happen? That's because we don't do anything or don't do enough in between those two periods. So we're not having enough opportunities to train as an adult. And firm-provided training has declined over decades. So we have a real issue that we need to do far more in the system to keep training people through their lives, but most importantly, to get at that bottom group who left the education system with very low levels of skill and don't really have the opportunity to recover from that?
There's lots going on in that answer. Let's just unpack it a bit. I mean, let's take this first figure of kind of one in six not having basic literacy skills. I imagine it also applies to numeracy. It's hardly likely that the people... Yeah.
It's even greater for numeracy.
It's even greater for numeracy. My God. Does that map on geographically to areas of deprivation where kind of incomes are lower than even the low average they are in Britain? People should know, by the way, that actually our per capita incomes are now lower than Slovenia on average. I mean, we're in many respects, Britain is more like a kind of middle-income developing country than an advanced country. And part of the story is the story that you're unpacking. Is there a correlation between living in an area of economic and social deprivation and being one of the people who end up being semi-illiterate, semi-innumerate?
Yes, and there are two things. There's, first of all, your family background, your family circumstances, your income as a child is a massive determinant of how well you do in the education system. And that is still true today, and it has been true for a very long time. So your own circumstances matter. But on top of that, you've also got very big regional disparities. So, I mean, going back to sort of, you know, do you make the GCSE mark, right? So if you take maths, around about sort of just over 40% of people in the area I was, Northeast, South Shields, get a good grade in maths GCSE. That rises to 60% if you go to Surrey. That rises to 70% if you're in Rutland. So where you're located in the country, yes, having a direct impact on your likelihood of having decent literacy and numeracy. But we mustn't forget it's also to do with your family circumstances, your own individual circumstances. Poverty really, really affects your likelihood of doing well in the system.
And there's a lot of very poor people in Britain. I mean, this is not kind of, it's kind of talked about, but the kind of knock-on consequences of it in terms of literacy and numeracy standards and the consequences of that for economic performance are not kind of discussed as widely as they perhaps should, as they should be. Let's know perhaps about it as they should be. What about, there's another figure that jumps out of your work, which I kind of really astonished me, was that only 1 in 10 teachers in socially kind of left behind areas actually has a science qualification, yet they're teaching science. 60% of maths teachers in Britain don't have a maths degree or qualification. It's astonishing. I mean, why is that? And are those figures right?
Yeah, so it's true that 1 in 10 maths lessons in poor schools is being taught by someone who has no science in their degree.
Is it 1 in 10 science lessons, 1 in 10 maths teachers?
1 in 10 science lessons being taught in poor schools is being taught by someone who has no science in their degree. And we have had maths, science and other teacher shortages now for a long time. We struggle to recruit. We struggle to retain. And all the research evidence on this is very clear that unless you've got a high-quality, thriving teacher workforce, you're going to really struggle to deliver good, sustained, quality education.
Well, what are the turnover figures? And just give us a sense of that and the difficulty in retention rates and hiring rates. Just give us some numbers so people get there. Sense of the difficulty.
So, I mean, one of the ways we measure difficulties in recruitment is whether you make the targets. This year, almost all of the targets are not met in terms of teacher recruitment. And over a longer period, you can say around about 3 in 5 teachers don't make it past the 5-year mark. But of course, those averages...
3 in 5 teachers or across all academic subjects.
And over, it depends, you know.
Don't make the 5-year mark. They leave teaching in the first 5 years of their career and go to other walks of life?
Yes, so many of them go on and do related work but outside teaching. And I think the real question for us is, you know, teaching should be a great job, right? It's working with kids. It's inherently an optimistic profession.
Fantastic. It's a fantastic profession. I mean, I just think, you know, Singapore is invoked as this kind of wonderful kind of free market paradise. They pay their teachers really seriously well.
Basically, when we think about the education system, remember what we're trying to do with the education system, if you think about it in a particular way, is counter the effects of, say, coming from a very deprived family. You're trying to offset that effect by doing better for that child in the education system. So they have a good chance of coming out with a decent set of, I don't know, GCSEs alongside everybody else. And that means you've got to really think about the people who are in that system trying to make that happen, which is where the teachers come in. And there's some nice research evidence that suggests that for a poorer student, the teaching is even more important. So in other words, if you come from a wealthy background, you've got teacher shortages in your school, you can't study a subject you want to study, perhaps, or maybe you have to do a bit of it on your own. If you come from a wealthy background, your parent will tend to help and step in. If you come from a poor background, that's all you've got. And that means that your education suffers as a consequence. So we've got to do better in terms of thinking about our teachers and our teacher workforce as a vital part of any thriving education system.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organisation behind the We Society podcast. The general election may be over, but that's only the beginning for the new government, as it has many pressing challenges to sort out. From education to the economy, every aspect of our society is crying out for fresh ideas and solutions. Social science stands ready to step up to the plate. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Let's just turn to your point about at 15, actually, the figures aren't so bad. By the time you get to adulthood, they've really fallen off a cliff. What's going on then between, say, 15 and 25?
So in most countries, as someone goes through upper secondary, they'll obviously gain some more skill. Then they go into the workforce. You'll have training provided by the firm. You might have some adult learning that the person themselves chooses to do. And so what we see that is that for a group of students in England, that's not happening. So they're not getting beyond the GCSE mark. Indeed, you know, just over 1 in 10 of them never even get to the GCSE level. So that's one problem. But also they don't get much of an opportunity to upskill after that. And I think this also relates to further education. We should talk more, I think, about further education. Further education colleges are where most of the people who will have low levels of skill will go at some point or other. But it's been a neglected sector for the whole of my academic career. We fund pupils at a lower level, we pay teachers in FE less, and yet they do vital, vital work trying to help those who are not academically bound to improve their skill levels. And again, there's been a lot of churn in that sector, and we need to do better, both in terms of funding it, but also planning for what we look for in a healthy system, healthy education system, over a long period of time.
What do we look for in a healthy education system over a long period of time?
So one of the things, of course, is the opportunity to come back from a disadvantaged start, right? So you've got to 15, 16, maybe you haven't done well at GCSE. That shouldn't determine the rest of your life. So you need opportunities for people to come back in. But I think you also need to have ladders that students can follow and have some idea where they're trying to get to and that are appropriate for people at different stages. Now, we have a very, very structured, rigid A-level to university kind of pathway that's very well known, and everybody knows what they're doing when they're on it, so to speak. What about the other half who are not going to university, but nonetheless need to develop their skills? Because we have massive shortages of vocational technical skills, right? This is really important. It comes full circle.
Well, 84% of firms say that's the recruiting skill folk is their most serious challenge. You know,
yeah, and it comes back to the we bit in we society, right? In terms of this is not a problem just for some individuals from poor backgrounds who don't have the levels of skill. It's a problem for us because we end up with a labour market that doesn't have the levels of skill.
And then you get immigration to kind of stem the gap, et cetera, et cetera. This kind of further education story and apprenticeship story and the cuts that have been made in the last kind of, particularly since 2010, as you say, it's a long-standing problem. But even from the indifferent levels, there were 20% real-term cuts over the last 14 years in further education. It really is a kind of Cinderella of the kind of education and training system. And then, you know, there's three applicants, only one apprenticeship place. And, I mean, the point that Professor Richard Layard makes, who I know you've worked with, if you've got A-levels and you want a place at a university, it's uncapped. There's a limitless amount of places. The universities are obliged to provide you a place. Not the story with further education, not the story with apprenticeships. I mean, it's a kind of one of the most glaring inequalities of setting up an education training system you can imagine, really. I mean, is that you share Richard Layard's view?
No, Richard's always right. Yes, I do share that view.
Well, he does get some things wrong.
I'm just joking. He's right, but there's also a wrinkle there that I think we don't emphasise enough, which is at one level, apprenticeships very successful and, you know, very valuable for the individuals who take them. But they rely on firms offering apprenticeship places. And where you live definitely affects the number of apprenticeship places that are on offer. Yeah. And for the vast majority of people who are not university bound, and indeed the vast majority of people who come from relatively low-income families, moving away to get more skills is not an option. You have to live at home, right?
Yeah.
So what's provided locally has a massive impact on what you personally can access. And we forget this when we're thinking in national data terms, that actually what really matters for the individual, particularly someone from a low-income household, is what is around them, what is available, what is the local FE college offering, and how many apprenticeship places are there? And it varies massively. And you're right, it's a big, big inequality compared to the graduate route.
If I made you Prime Minister for a week and said, OK, you've got you know, three things you can do. You've not got limitless funds, but you've got, you know, there are budget constraints. So I want your proposals to be feasible. And what would they be? What would your three things be, or four things, or two things?
So first of all, I think we need to think about parity of investment in both halves of our population, those that go through FE and those that head to HE. So that would be a first thing. The second thing I would do is say, well, we definitely need to pay teachers more. That's true. But we need to make it a better job. And if we don't have a lot of money, we really need to work hard at making it a better job without money, right? And so there are things that you can do, probably involving asking teachers to do less of some things, that could make it a better job. And I think we really need to focus our minds on that first and foremost. And then I think the other aspect of this is people need better signposting and ladders through the system that allow them to make mistakes and then come back and get training or skills that they need that they missed out the first time. And that's a sort of technical point about, you know, making sure that you can move, for example, between vocational and academic systems, that accreditation in one system might be valid in another.
Have academy schools been a success?
Early academies were shown in some research studies to be more effective.
In London particularly, or just more
London general? Is definitely. London schools generally have in various
but
studies.
Was that academies or was that?
Well, exactly. So London Challenge was an intervention that wasn't just about academies. It was also about some levels of investment in London, but a number of other aspects to that project. And London schools are the real success story over the last 20 years or so. There's no doubt about that. But the academies now are, the last evidence I looked at, are no more or less effective than any other school. My point on that would be structures matter an awful lot less than we think in terms of influencing children's achievement. And if I was going to focus on anything, and perhaps I should have said this at the beginning, if I'm Prime Minister for a week, obviously having high levels of poverty will be the main driver. Poverty lands on the next generation in a really big way. So first and foremost, you should be worrying about trying to improve the financial circumstances of children in very poor families. And that certainly is far more important than worrying about the structures in the education system.
Now, do you see yourself as a social scientist? Do you see yourself as an educational theorist, as an academic who's putting her intellectual capacities to the service of a great cause, or all of the above? I mean, how do you see yourself?
So I see myself as a social scientist first and foremost. And the reason for that is I'm trained as an economist. I worked in the field of education. I'm now having the privileged position of being the director of a big, you know, research funding organization.
Leverhulme Trust, yeah.
Leverhulme Trust. And we fund a lot of interdisciplinary work. And
is the focus interdisciplinary? Is that how you...
That's one of the focus. The two focuses of the Leverhulme Trust are basically basic research, fundamental research, research that you don't really know what it's going to do, but it seems like a good idea to try and find out, yeah. But also interdisciplinary. And if you think of all those problems that, you know, the world faces, most of them are not single discipline problems. Most of them are interdisciplinary. Education, particularly, is a very multifaceted issue. And I think those of us working in education inevitably end up feeling that we're social scientists because you're drawing on psychology, economics, sociology. It's impossible to answer education questions without really reaching for a whole wide range of different social science disciplines.
For those who don't know, give the podcast listeners some sense of, you know, the monies that you disperse, say, annually. 50 million, 100 million a year.
So this is why I have a great job. So I get to give away, not personally, you understand, about £120 million of funding a year. And as you said at the beginning, we fund right the way across the disciplines, including social science, not medicine. And in terms of the kinds of grants we offer, we try to provide grants for every stage of an academic's career. So our grants can go from as small as, you know, £2,000 to support a student, right through to £10 million research centres and everything in between. But the really unique sort of feature of the Leverhulme Trust is that we don't have a top-down steer on what people should be researching. This is why academics like us. Basically, you send us your best ideas and we fund those that we can. And there is no agenda. We genuinely believe that academics at the forefront of their field are going to be in the best position to decide what the really important research question is. And that's how we operate.
It's a kind of liberal institution in the best sense of the word. What's your proudest achievement at the Leverhulme Trust? What do you think is the kind of, where have you made a difference, do you think?
So the Leverhulme Trust has been funding grants for about 150 years. And in many respects, it does an amazing job. And when I came in, it was, certainly wasn't the case that I wanted to, you know, rip things up and change things around a bit. But one thing I was really acutely conscious of from my own research on inequality was that we have a massive problem of underrepresentation, particularly of black academics and low-income people in academia. And it's not a problem that a research funder can necessarily solve that easily, because the people just are not in the academic pipeline. So one of the new innovations that we've introduced is an additional amount of funding to support PhDs from black and low-income households or families to go from master's to PhD and hopefully into academia. And there's a real issue in our system of the jump from undergraduate to postgraduate in terms of funding. It's hard to get funding to do that postgraduate master's.
Yeah, no, been there.
Yeah. And that's where we felt that we really needed to offer some more support. So our PhD programs, our doctoral centres in the last round last year, now include specific slots for black and low-income students in the hope that we can improve that in terms of representation.
Anna Vignolis, thank you very much. It's been a great interview. You've covered a lot of ground. You've introduced us to the extraordinary inequalities of access to the disadvantaged kids from disadvantaged areas being taught maths largely by people who don't have a kind of maths background, the differential performance, your chance of getting a GCSE depending on which part of the country you're in, the extraordinary kind of lacuna between 15-year-olds and what happens in adulthood, and the way we just don't support people as they try to acquire the vocational skills they require. All the time you've emphasized that actually it's not only a problem for those people as individuals, but for, inverted commas, the we, that knock-on effects on economic performance and social performance are there for all to see. It's been fascinating and important, and I wish you great good luck. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton. The episode was produced by Emily Finch and was a Whistledown production for the Academy of Social Sciences. Be sure to subscribe to the We Society on the podcast hosting platform of your choosing so you can be the first to hear new episodes, and go to acss.org.uk to learn more about the Academy of Social Sciences.